Going to talk about Charlie Chaplin shortly. How well loved was Charlie Chaplin? And that recognition of talent just continues through the decades since his death. He'd had an incredibly, incredibly tough childhood. He was thrown out of America because of his belief, or there was a belief the FBI didn't like him. They thought that he was a communist and they thought they should get rid of him. So we take a look at the life of Charlie Chaplin. Dan Cameron joins us. He's the author of The Comedy of Charlie Chaplin, and he joins us on the line. Hello, Dan.
How do you do, Trevor?
Dan, what an incredible childhood Charlie Chaplin had, and what a tough childhood.
Yes, but he wasn't born in Australia, so he had that going for him.
That's true. Tell us what it was like for him.
Well, you know, he often said that he was born... The reason I say that is he often would say in early interviews that he was born in Fontainebleau, France, because he wanted to kind of cover up the fact that he was born in the direst poverty in slums of London to a mother who went insane, which he kept from the public for many, many years, and the father who died an alcoholic when he was 12 years old. Charlie was 12, not his father, of course. And he was on the streets, and he was in and out of the workhouses, the orphan asylums, and the good part of that was he was employed professionally by the time he was 9 years old. He started becoming a stage performer and had an amazing stage performance background. But that doesn't change the fact that he was deeply scarred and wounded. One writer I was just reading who knew him, who was hired by Chaplin to work at his studio, said that his childhood wrote with a heavy hand upon him, and it's very true.
When you take a look at that, because he was a dancer at a young age and he was with a group called the Eight Lancashire Lads, he was managing to bring himself through that period and into burlesque.
That's right. Yes, he had a very varied... At first, he was put into his dad, partially to get his mother off his back about support payments, got him into a music hall troupe called the Eight Lancashire Lads, which toured for several years, and that's he learned the basics of dancing and also experimented with some other kind of performing, and after that got into some burlesque, what we would call sketch comedy troupes, and as well as doing legit theater. He was in the first British production of a famous play about Sherlock Holmes that went around that was co-written by Arthur Conan Doyle and an American named William Gillette.
What was it then that, because there we see his ability to do comedy as well as to act. Where was it, or why was it he went to America firstly?
Well, he got into a comedy troupe that was the equivalent, well, in America I would say the equivalent of Saturday Night Live. Do you get that over there?
Yeah.
Just it's simply the top comedy troupe in the world at the time, the Fred Carno company of speechless comedians, sometimes speechless. And his brother got him involved when Charlie was about 17 years old, and he was offered the chance to go to America in 1910 with one of the Carno companies, because they toured the entire world. Carno had 30 or 40 companies that toured simultaneously in England and the continent and elsewhere, and these were companies that did largely visual, very precise physical comedy sketches, such as the signature one that Charlie made a big hit in America was called, in England, Mumming Birds. And in America, they changed the name because nobody knew the word mumming. They changed the name to A Night in an English Music Hall. And he played, on the stage was fake stage boxes and a fake proscenium, and there would be a series of bad acts, which the actors in the company who were sitting in the box, in the fake boxes on stage, would basically heckle and interact with. And he played what became his signature role with the Carno Company, the part of the of a drunk who just mixes it up and causes chaos. And that's a role that he would repeat throughout his life, really, in films as well. But he became very well known and doing that, and the company crisscrossed America for 4 years, and during that time there were four or five different sketches they played, because the Carno Company had at least 30 or 40 sketches and they knew them all. They had the sets for about four or five of them, and you can see in the reviews, the reviews have been traced by a remarkable writer named A.J. Marriott from England, who actually made it his business to try to track down Chaplin's every stage performance he ever did. And he found reviews, and people would start anticipating the return of Charlie Chaplin, who was the head of the company at that time in America, the head of the American company, whose understudy, by the way, was Stan Laurel.
Really?
Yes. And they wrote about each other. You know, Chaplin didn't write about Laurel, but Laurel wrote quite a bit about Chaplin to interviewers and spoke about him always, about how amazing he was on the stage and about the relationship they had.
Was he young to be in that position and to be recognized so highly in comedy?
Chaplin?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things that happened is when Mack Sennett, who owned the Keystone Comedy Company that had just started up a year or two before, saw him perform in 1913, he said, "That's the guy I want." And when Chaplin showed up, he got him hired for this to make comedies. And when Chaplin showed up, Sennett was apparently appalled because Chaplin at the time was 24 years old, but he looked about 16. And maybe that's the reason that the first film he made was considered the flop by everybody, because he put on the kind of old age makeup of the type he did on stage, and it was a bit broad for movies. But with the second film that he made, he came up with his amazing character, and what's amazing about it in that film called Kid Auto Races at Venice. It was almost a newsreel type film where they went to a real kid soapbox derby race and they said, "Do something funny. We have a fake camera filming the event and just interfere with him." And it's a one joke film. He simply keeps on stepping in front of the camera and hogging and you know, looking like he's about to walk in the path of these rolling soapboxes, and the director keeps on getting more and more exasperated, and they just kind of repeat this. But what's amazing about it is you see his first stab at the character, which he didn't play on the stage, as far as we know, in any of the Carno sketches. He made him up, and we see the first audience watching Charlie Chaplin on film. They're the live audience. They're real people, and we watch as they get more and more involved and start to laugh.
Isn't it interesting that that character is what we associate Charlie Chaplin to be?
It was such a genius stroke to have come up with that costume, because the essential joke of the character, the essential comedy of the character, is inherent in the costume, which is a man who is dressed in kind of ragged hand-me-downs that are mismatched, look like they got them in the dustbin, but they're the hand-me-downs of a rich person, and he affects the airs of a rich person, despite the fact that he's clearly a bum.
And the little mustache.
And he, you know, that's part of the vanity of the character. Never looks dirty at all. He's always making jokes about it. He cleans his fingernails with the end of his cane and so on. And that was the essential joke: a poor man pretending to be rich.
But the ability to take that character through so many films and strong in so many films as well.
It is an extraordinary lifespan for any actor. I mean, we've had actors who have a long lifespan, but except for Woody Allen out there and Jacques Tati in the 1950s and 60s, we don't have actors who wrote their own material, played their own character, and that the audience followed the continuing adventures of that one character again and again and again in that way. And Chaplin mesmerized the world for 25 years playing that character, up until the time he essentially sacrificed the character to try to do something about World War II as it was just beginning, playing Hitler.
Hello, Eva.
I can't remember. Did Charlie Chaplin marry Una when he was in his 60s or in his 80s?
Dan?
Well, he was married. He married her in his 50s. He was 53 and she was 18. But they remained married all the rest of his life. He lived till he was 88 years old. And Una actually died the same week that we began making the Chaplin biography with Robert Downey. I say we because I taught Robert Downey to be Charlie Chaplin for that film.
One of the things that I found interesting in reading about him was that his film process of making his movies, that he never had a completed script or a completed story. He would start it and then work through the process and create the film as he went along.
When sound films came in, he had to, like with The Great Dictator, where he played Hitler, he had to, for economic reasons, he had to write out a script. But the comedy scenes were essentially improvised. Even Limelight, the last American film he made in the early 50s, the scene that climaxes it, he does a comedy routine with Buster Keaton, and essentially there was nothing in the script written about it. He improvised it with Keaton while the cameras were rolling, basically. And that's how he worked and learned to work during the silent era, too. We can see this because the outtakes of many of his early films have been preserved, and you just see him putting it together on the fly, as it were, while the cameras are rolling. And he's the first mime, the first comedian, really, of genius, who could watch himself. He could shape his performance by watching himself, because he'd watch the rushes every day and see what he'd done the previous day and then go back and do it again.
Trevor joins us. Good morning, Trevor.
I'll admit I'm largely basing what I'm saying on the memory of the film of about 20 years ago, Richard Attenborough's biography with Robert Downey Jr.
Mm-hmm.
But from other sources too, I believe that on that first tour to America, where Attenborough's film does mention the relationship with Charlie and Stan Laurel, but I believe a very important little incident stuck somewhere, I believe, in a small town in Montana. Charlie met six stage brothers named Marks, and particularly struck up a lifelong friendship with Groucho.
Dan, was there a relationship there?
Well, Groucho wrote, in the 1930s, Groucho wrote about the first time he saw Charlie Chaplin, which was in Winnipeg, Canada, actually. And he said he was about to leave because they had played out a gig there, and he happened to go to the theater, and he saw the funniest thing he'd ever seen in the theater. And what he saw was one of those touring shows. It was called A Night in a London Club. And you know, there's some newsreel footage of them playing tennis together for some charity event, but I don't know how much of a friendship they had. I'm sure they all knew each other, and they were all at the same parties in the 1930s. Chaplin was not very generous in praising other people, but he told Groucho that he would love to be able to talk like he does from the screen.
A texter is saying that Charlie Chaplin was in a movie with Buster Keaton. We're just talking about that. I've heard mixed stories that he treated Buster Keaton with disrespect. Is that true or false?
Well, if he did, then Buster Keaton certainly never said anything about it. He said it was one of the high points of his life to do that film, and he would have done it for free, because people criticized Chaplin because he didn't pay Keaton commensurate to Keaton's stardom, but he didn't pay anybody very well. I mean, the leading ladies in his films were getting $50 or $60 a week and things, because they could, the same way that Woody Allen gets today's superstar du jour, and they're all doing it for a fraction of what they can make elsewhere because they want to be in a Woody Allen film. It was the same thing. It was the Rolls Royce of the art. It was the apex to be asked by Charlie Chaplin to be in a film, and Keaton loved the opportunity. And a rumor went around that Chaplin cut out his best bits, but you know, he looks awfully good in the film to me, and you know, and it's a beautiful climax, really, to the end of his American filmmaking career, to have brought in his old colleague, which for many people, the two giants of silent film are Keaton and Chaplin, and of course Harold Lloyd is less known now, but at the time was enormously popular, and they all had great respect for each other. I met Buster Keaton's widow, and he told me that he and Charlie would hang out and just talk about gags in the kitchen and things.
We're talking about the life of Charlie Chaplin this morning with Dan Kamen, who's the author of The Comedy of Charlie Chaplin. How did he handle the transition from silent films to talkies, given that he was such a strong physical comedian?
Well, he did it with some very ingenious hedging. The first film that he released in the talkie era was City Lights, and it had already been mostly shot during the late 20s, when Hollywood still thought there would be silent movies as well as talkies and musicals and things like plays, which, you know, the early term for movies was called photo plays. But the public said no. The public stopped going to silent films. But when City Lights was released in 1931, it was the only silent movie that had been released in the previous 2 years. It had a soundtrack, which he composed, but other than that, it's essentially a silent movie, and it was the third highest-grossing movie of the year. The first was in America. The first was Frankenstein, and the public was still avid to see Charlie Chaplin. His second film is a kind of hybrid called Modern Times, in which he lets words come in, but the plot of the film, he's a factory worker who's fired because of a strike. He's unemployed because of a strike, and he can't find work. And at the end, the plot forces him to get a job as a singing waiter. And the whole world had been waiting to hear Charlie Chaplin speak, as earlier they had waited to hear Greta Garbo speak and all the other big silent movie stars. And Chaplin made them wait till 1936, and then he teased them because as he's going out for his dance and song, he accidentally throws his cuffs off. He doesn't have the lyrics, and so he sings in gibberish. And at the same time, he mimes this very eloquent and very bold story about a flirtation that's essentially a kind of a naughty French prostitution story. that was a worldwide hit. And then when he fully broke silence, he did it too because he had something to say. He wanted to lampoon Hitler in 1940. And do something, use his platform, his enormous platform of popularity, to get out the message that this is not something we leave alone. We've got to stop this guy now. And that was something that got him in great trouble with the authorities in the United States, the political forces who may have agreed with him, but felt that mere entertainer should not be trying to influence public opinion. Well, and ultimately that started the reversal of opinion in America about Chaplin.
Let's pick up on that period of time after the Great Dictator and the perception from government. There was also the feeling that he was a communist and he got caught up in the whole communist thing around Hollywood at that time.
Absolutely. And even the Great Dictator was used as evidence against him because you weren't supposed to be against nobody liked Hitler, but you weren't supposed to be vocally anti-fascist. The term in America was premature anti-fascist because the people who really wanted us to stay away from Hitler were the communists, because at that time they were in league together. They had signed a non-aggression pact with each other until Hitler went ahead and attacked Russia stupidly a year later. The combination of Chaplin's outspoken left-wing beliefs and also the sexual scandals that he tended to get into. There was a rather notorious paternity suit, and the anti-Chaplin feeling we now know was very stoked by the FBI here and by right-wing forces within the culture, groups like the American Legion, super patriot groups, and we now know that he had a relationship with this poor woman who accused him, but it ended long before her baby was born, and we know that essentially she was put up to it by these forces. And the anti-Chaplin feeling was such that even though blood tests proved that he couldn't be the father of the child, he was still ordered to pay child support. So people looked at it as American culture went swung way right in the last years, and during especially the post-war years into the McCarthy era here. And for many people, the fact that he'd had a relationship with this woman, which he didn't deny, was enough to brand him as an old lecher and a kind of unsavory moral character. And it was, of course, in stark contrast to the character he played, who played an innocent, accepted in sort of street survival, but in terms of sophistication, a very innocent kind of character, which was the opposite of the way Chaplin started to be seen.
Did that relationship that he had politically wasn't necessarily good, but did that flow over to his films by which people stopped seeing them or stopped going?
Oh yes, there were very organized campaigns in America which were orchestrated by the FBI, and we now know by groups like the American Legion, which is a veterans group, to boycott his films. And even though his film Limelight, the one with Buster Keaton, is an elegiac film, well, what he did was he tried, his art was always, he was always very autobiographical as an artist. And after The Great Dictator and the scandal of the paternity suit, which dragged on for a year or so, he made a film called Monsieur Verdu, in which he makes fun of the fact that everybody is looking at him as this old lecher by playing the French historical character Landru, who made his living by marrying wealthy widows and then murdering them after getting their money. And he made this as a comedy. He called it a comedy of murders. It was a huge flop. It was his first real flop in America, and he responded by making Limelight in the early 50s, which is a film about a comedian who's lost his audience. And that, you know, a less political film you couldn't imagine, except in this autobiographical sense, and yet Limelight was boycotted. It never played a week out in any American theater.
Tell us the circumstances by which he left the country and then was subsequently not allowed back.
Well, he left to introduce the film in Europe and to show his family, his growing family. He had four children by then with Una, to show them where he grew up. And he was a resident alien. He never got American citizenship, neither did Stan Laurel and neither did Alfred Hitchcock till a bit later. But nobody ever thought about it with, you know, it was just an accepted thing. He was a very well-paying guest in this country. And he applied as a matter of routine for his re-entry visa before leaving. And then after he left, when the boat was out a couple of days or 3 days, he got a telegram saying that the re-entry visa was revoked, and he would have to essentially appear before a tribunal to determine if he was morally and politically fit to be readmitted to the United States. And, you know, there would be no question that he would have been readmitted, but at that point, he felt enough was enough, and he did not. He settled in Europe, as you probably know. He settled in Switzerland and lived the rest of his life there. And he came back only one time in triumph to receive an honorary Oscar in 1972, which not coincidentally coincided with the re-release of his film. So it's all about art and it's all about money with Charlie Chaplin. He was a very shrewd artist.
Was he bitter? And when the Academy did recognize him, was there a feeling that he didn't really want to accept that?
You know, Chaplin's career, his relationship to the American public and the world public was a love fest. And only in America did it sour in that era of the McCarthy time, the late 40s, early 50s. But he still had, you know, he was still getting fan letters. I wrote one of them myself. I wrote a fan letter to him in the 70s. And you know, he received a level of adulation that's only comparable to, you know, the Beatles and a very few other Elvis, a very few other artists ever get that. But at the same time, he really felt he was an American, and it stung very deeply that he had run into that, quite orchestrated campaign to turn the public against him. The love fest became a hate fest for a while, but he came back, and it was all very bittersweet, as are his films.
Owen, good morning.
Does your friend know what his favorite saying was?
I'd like to know it.
Well, what do you think it is there, Owen?
Well, I know what it is. It's a day without laughter is a day wasted.
Yes, well, if he didn't say that, he should have.
Good on you. Thank you, Owen. Good morning, Maureen.
My dad and Charlie Chaplin were second cousins. My dad used to say to us, if I'd done what Charlie wanted to do, we wouldn't be in Australia. We would have. He wanted my dad to go to America with him when he was young, because my dad had lost his father when he was only three, and Charlie was a good deal older than him, and he wanted my dad to go to America with him, but my dad didn't, and we eventually came out to Australia.
So there is a relationship with Australia, Dad?
Oh, yeah. Like I said, he and my dad were second cousins.
Good stuff, thank you. Were you aware of that, Dan?
No.
There.
What's his name?
See, there's a link with us from everywhere. What's his name, Maureen?
My dad was Joseph Hodges.
Thank you very much. Dan, you've done a lot of research, and you obviously recognise and know him as close as you can through doing that, and also working with Robert Downey Jr. on this. What is it that really struck you with all the research that you've done about Charlie Chaplin that you either didn't know before or really highlighted to you in his character?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure what you're asking, Trevor. What about the research struck me as the most?
Yeah, when you've done the research and you've taken a look at his life and his character, what were the things that struck you mostly about him?
Well, I would say it's not the research at all. I was heading for a quite different life myself, and my college, I'd never seen a Charlie Chaplin film because he had been pretty well erased from the culture through the 50s and into the early 60s, and I went to college in the 60s, and I saw my first Charlie Chaplin film while I was there, and it simply changed my life. I walked out of the theater into a different life because it was the best film I'd ever seen, and I still think it's the best film I've ever seen. It's The Gold Rush, his film from 1925, and it's a comedy, but it's a comedy about men who are snowbound in Alaska, gold prospectors, and they turn to cannibalism, which is based on, you know, some real events that happened in America. And so it was a very harrowing film, but also very funny. And I'd never seen a film that was so serious and yet so funny at the same time, and yet it was all expressed in, without saying a word, just in the actions of the characters and the movements that the way he moved as an actor. You could say he's almost dancing. You could say as a director that he's a choreographer as much as a director. I'd never seen a film that was all these things, and so I simply had to become a part of it, and it changed my life. I became a professional comedian and performer, and I now play with symphonies all over the world. I've worked with a couple of Australian conductors doing it, as a matter of fact, and so he literally changed my life. And I go back to his films as I do to a well, and because I always see new things. The work is his thinking on a visual level was simply so profound that it continues to speak to us. It's about the deepest, you know, the sorrow of his childhood, the horror, the tragedy, insanity, and alcoholism. It's all there in his films. You can see it transmuted into the most profound comedy that's ever been made.
And when you take a look at good comedy that's made now, it works in the same process.
Absolutely. Well, comedy is, you know, all comedy speaks, all art, you know, it doesn't mean anything unless it speaks to us. And I simply found the art of Charlie Chaplin spoke to me at the deepest level and literally woke up in me the impulse to recreate experience in movement the way Charlie Chaplin did. And that's the nature of his work and why it's always so accessible to people. You know, I work in Asia quite a bit, and when I went there at first, there was a press conference in China, and I said something about The Wizard of Oz, meaning the Judy Garland film. None of them had ever heard about it. Mm. Of course, why would you think they had? And then I said something about, Charlie Chaplin, and they all put their finger under their nose and waggled an imaginary cane, and everybody could imitate. As John Lennon got notorious for saying that we're more popular than Christ, Chaplin said that never publicly, but he said it privately to people, and it was quite true because everybody got the joke. Everybody could. He would say to people, you know, they've never heard of Jesus Christ, but everybody can do this walk, and it's true because he found the comedy in the ordinary things of life. How do you walk? How do you light a cigarette? So it's funny. How do you step on a curb? How do you turn a corner? How do you flirt with a girl? How do you tip your hat? He found the joke in things that are just you don't think about, and for that reason, he makes us see the world in a different way.
Dan, that's a lovely way of concluding the conversation with you this morning. Thank you very much for your time.
It's been a pleasure talking with you, Trevor.
Dan Cameron is the author of The Comedy of Charlie Chaplin. You're listening to Overnights on ABC Local Radio.